Krug of Wolf Parade, Sunset Rubdown, and Moonface. This unique festival finds bands and music artists upstairs, while downstairs you get access to the coziest grandma's living room style lounge in the city, with DJs, hot food, drinks, on-site tattoo artists, and more. The second annual Unreal City Festival, January 15th to 17th at the Rickshaw Theater and the Russian Hall in East Vancouver. For passes, go to unrealcity.rocks or head to CJSF Music on Instagram to win tickets.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
I mean, the public relations industry does not spend over $1 billion a year for fun. The public relations industry was created, and it's an American invention, was created in the early part of the century, as its leaders put it, to control the public mind, which they said is the greatest danger facing corporations.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on manufacturing consent. The media like to present themselves as objective, balanced, and free from any bias or agenda. Reality suggests something quite different. The media function as weapons of mass distraction. Much of what passes as news is sometimes subtle, sometimes crude propaganda. The media are large conglomerates that serve to mobilize support for the special interests that dominate state and corporate power. In democratic societies, populations are not controlled by force. Rather, they are subject to more refined forms of ideological manipulation. Emotionally potent oversimplifications and necessary illusions are created and repeated endlessly. Embedded ideas, such as Washington's right to intervene anywhere in the world, go unexamined and unchallenged. Consent is manufactured. The public, reduced to being spectators, is marginalized. To talk about manufacturing consent is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist who's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. The New Statesman calls him the conscience of the American people. At 97, and though having health setbacks, he continues to inform and inspire people all over the world. He's the author of scores of books, including Surviving the 21st Century, The Myth of American Idealism, and Manufacturing Consent. During Alternative Radio's 40th anniversary year, we'll be airing some of Chomsky's classic presentations. The one you're about to hear was recorded in 1993 at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And now, Noam Chomsky, Manufacturing Consent.
Print media are major corporations, print and television. The big media are, you know, there are a few exceptions here and there, like community-based radio. But for the over the big range, the media are major corporations, parts of even bigger conglomerates like GE and Westinghouse and so on. Like other corporations, they have a product and a market. The market is other businesses, namely advertisers, and the product is audiences, which they sell to the advertisers. Obviously, television channels don't make any money when you tune them in, and the newspapers usually lose money when you buy a copy. But the people are the product being sold to the, from the point of view of political economy, if you want to use a fancy word for it, the people, the audiences are the product being sold to the businesses. Now, the media are, of course, differentiated. So there are more kind of elite-oriented media, and there are sort of real mass popular media. The elite-oriented media try to sell an upscale product. In fact, their advertising rates go up often if their readership declines. If they can tilt the income and class bias toward the wealthy, there are all kind of complicated ways of measuring this in the advertising industry. So the elite media, like say the New York Times or the Washington Post and so on, are pretty much trying to sell a kind of a upscale audience, an audience of people who are roughly play some kind of decision-making role in the society, with one of the other institutions or something like that, are professionals and so on. They try to sell them to other businesses. They are also the media which more or less set the agenda for others. They have the big resources. They set the framework within which the others pretty much operate. So if you're if you take a look at, say, the Associated Press wires every day, you know, they keep churning out this junk all the time. And around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the news pieces break, and there's something called notice to editors. The New York Times is considering the following stories for its front page tomorrow. And if you're the editor of, you know, the Des Moines, whatever it is, you look at that and you say, okay, that's tomorrow's news. And in the page or whatever that I devote to news, those are the stories that I'll feature. Even the television news channels more or less pick up the framework of their reporting from that morning's Times and Post and maybe Wall Street Journal and a few others marginally. So you have big agenda-setting corporations, which are huge, very profitable corporations, in fact, some of the most profitable in the country, who are selling elite audiences to other businesses. Now, that's print media and television also. Radio. Radio became a major potential, you know, medium of expression sort of in the late 20s and the early 30s. And there was a kind of a conflict at that time about what should be done with radio. It has a limited number of channels. It's not like the newspapers where you can have as many as you like. But there's a limited number of radio channels. And the issue arose as to whether these are a public good or whether they should be handed over to the corporate world. And it wasn't much of a struggle, but it was a struggle that went on for a while. There were church groups and public interest groups and others who argued that radio, since it's a government decision, you know, it ought to be, at least a sector of radio ought to be, thanks, devoted to public interest. The unions were marginally involved. There were some unions, particularly in Chicago, that pressed for labor-oriented radio, and they had pretty big audiences, in fact, ran some stations for a while, but the union bureaucracy wasn't much interested. That was, you know, their business unionism. They wanted the corporations to have it. Within a couple of, there was a big corporate offensive, huge corporate offensive to try to overcome this, and within a couple of years, radio just became another corporate monopoly, virtually, you know, with marginal things around the edges. So that's another case of big corporations selling audiences to advertisers. When television came along, it wasn't even an issue anymore. It was just taken for granted. Well, that's the political economy of the media. If you look at that system, you can make some guesses about what the media product will be. That is, the guess of any rational observer would be that, say, take the elite agenda-setting media, that the way in which they depict the world would be shaped by the interests of the sellers, the buyers, and the audience, the product. That would be a plausible assumption, you know, kind of the null hypothesis, if you like. You'd want to have to shoot that one down. Well, that assumption is off the agenda. You're not allowed to discuss it. So, for example, if there's an academic study of the media, that possibility is not allowed. That's the possibility that my colleague Edward Herman and I called the propaganda model of the media, which suggests that the way in which the media depict reality will reflect the interests of power, which means in private power and the state power that's closely linked to it. that's not a discussable topic. You can't. It's not that anybody tries to refute it. It's not allowed to be discussed. But if you want to study the media, say you're from Mars, you know, you're not part of the ideological system, and you want to study the media the way, say, a scientist would, that's the first hypothesis you would look at. And if you bothered to look at it, you would find that it's overwhelmingly supported by the evidence. I mean, it isn't even close. There are by now mountains of evidence proving from every point of view that what any reasonable person would expect from the political economy of the media is true. Not a big surprise, in a way. But it doesn't matter, again, how well you prove that. I mean, you can prove it by the standards of physics, and it's still not going to enter, say, the Kennedy School, you know, department on the media or whatever, because it's not allowed. You're not allowed to think that. You're not allowed to think that the media might, the way they work, might reflect the interests of power in the society. That's an unthinkable thought. And in a well-controlled doctrinal system, you're not supposed to think unthinkable thoughts. You don't argue about them. You don't refute them. You just don't think them. And the way this is done is very standard. If you read the Boston Globe, you may have seen an article a couple of days ago by Thomas Palmer, front page story, about the liberal takeover, the left liberal takeover of the media. And it's not debated, you know, it's just like a fact. And then we start from there and we ask why it happened, you know, or how bad it is and so on. Or just, I think, yesterday or the day before, there was another front page article on the takeover of the entire culture by PC left fascists or something. It's not debatable, you know, it's just like a fact. We start from there and we ask how bad it is and, you know, whether there's anything to do about it and so on. Same is true in academic studies. You look at academic studies in the media, I mean, it's child's play to demonstrate that on issues like, say, Central America or the Middle East or Indochina or you pick it, the media constantly and with virtually with no variation, I mean, slightest variation, adopted the framework of government propaganda as the basis for discussion and then sort of discussed tactical issues within it. Again, there's masses of material on that. But the study, the academic studies of the media are not allowed to raise that question. The only question they ask is whether the media went too far in their adversarial stance. You know, are they so opposed to power? Are they so biased against anybody with money or power that they're undermining democracy and so on? Well, that's a useful technique. It's kind of sometimes been called the thief-thief technique. The idea is if you're caught with your hand in somebody's pocket, the smartest thing to do, you don't defend yourself. That's a mistake. That suggests there's an issue. What you do is yell thief, thief. You know, say he's the thief. I'm the victim. And then it doesn't matter whether you prove it or not. You've won the discussion because the debate is all the spectrum has shifted over to that. Well, that's the way media critique is done, and that's it's thief, thief. The next topic is to show that in fact the expectation is correct. That is to look at actual treatment of issues and see if they work the way a reasonable person would expect given the political economy. That's the substantive issue. Let me try to put it in a somewhat broader framework, however. All of this is part of the theory of democracy. The media, after all, are just one part of the doctrinal system. There are also schools and universities and churches and all kind of other things. And underlying them all is a problem. A big problem that's arisen in Western societies since the 17th century. It began to arise in 17th century England when the first popular democratic revolutions took place. The problem was that it was becoming, through popular struggles, were reaching the point where it was harder and harder to control the public by force. I mean, in a feudal society or an absolutist state or what we nowadays call a totalitarian state, the problem of controlling opinion is not a very big deal, really. People can think whatever they like. If they get out of line, you know, you beat them over the head, or you send them to the gulag, or whatever. So they're more or less free to think what they want. And in fact, it's not really important. Propaganda, I mean, we think of propaganda as being associated with totalitarian states, but that's really a mistake. The propaganda in totalitarian states is very crude and easy to see through, and a lot of people see through it. It comes from the Ministry of Truth or something, and it's labeled "I am propaganda," you know, and then you look at it and everybody laughs. And in fact, they often don't care a lot what people think. So, for example, there have been some studies of the Soviet Union you know, the model totalitarian state pre-Gorbachev, now, like, say, you know, under Brezhnev. And it turned out that, you know, something like 95% of the population was listening to foreign broadcasts, meaning getting news from BBC and Voice of America and so on and so forth. And a huge proportion of the population, like, I don't think it was something like 50%, was reading Samizdat, you know, the underground, so-called underground suppressed literature, but of course it was all over the place. You know, a dissident in the United States couldn't reach 0.001% of the population. It's inconceivable. But in Russia, they didn't care very much if they were reaching 50%, because there isn't a lot they can do about it anyway. You know, there's just too much force at command. And other totalitarian states are often like that. As societies become more free, however, through popular struggle, it's not a gift from anybody, the problem begins to arise of controlling opinion. You can't control people by force anymore. And that's raised right away from the 17th century, from the first democratic revolutions. The elite, even people we think of these days as libertarians, like John Locke, you really look at what they said, they were worried about what they called the rascal multitude, or the rabble, you know, this big mass of people out there who are getting involved in things which are none of their business, like running public affairs or influencing them. And usually you can just sort of kick them in the face and the problem's over. But sometimes you can't, you know, and therefore you have to think of ways of getting them to have the right beliefs. And that comes right up to the present. It's always assumed, you look at democratic theory, it is assumed throughout that the big problem is how to keep the public out of it, how to keep the rabble out of trouble, you know. So take, say, the founding fathers, you know. When this country, it was the first sort of modern democratic society, and the assumption of the founding fathers was, they're frank and open in those days, they don't hide things, that the people who own the country ought to govern it. That's the way John Jay put it, and more or less everybody agreed. People who own the country ought to govern it, and the general public are only going to cause trouble. So the management of the country, you know, the actual rulers, the people and president and that kind of stuff, they should be what are called men of virtue, you know, steeped in the classical tradition, modeling themselves on Roman republicans and that kind of business. And they would sort of run things for the people who own the country. But the general public had to be kept out of it. Sometimes it wasn't so simple, like in, around Massachusetts, say, it was necessary to teach rebellious farmers by force that what was written in the revolutionary pamphlets didn't mean anything. That was, they were to forget about that. It was going to go back to being an aristocracy, just of a different kind. Well, okay, there are various vicissitudes. Things change over the years. The franchise is extended. You know, people win freedom. Slavery ended. I mean, all kind of things happen. Women actually got the right to vote after only 150 years, 200 years after the revolution. Blacks got a formal right to vote. I mean, there is slow progress. But the general theory remains the same. And in fact, as the franchise extends and freedom of speech extends and the public is able to do more and more things, the problem simply intensifies. By the 1920s, it was becoming pretty, the discussion of it becomes pretty sophisticated. And if you look at what are called progressive democratic essays and progressive liberal thinking and so on, by, say, the 1920s, it becomes quite open. And then becomes a major part of, you know, academic profession and so on and so forth. The phrase manufacturing consent, which was used on this lecture title, is actually taken from Walter Lippmann, who was the dean of American journalists and one of the leading progressive intellectuals from the Dewey Circle. And in fact, one of the few people who really, I mean, he's pretty conservative, but he kind of like would take labor's side. He criticized the media, say, for their rotten treatment of unions and so on, and for their lies about the Bolshevik Revolution. I mean, he was a pretty independent thinker by the standards of, you know, the intellectual culture. But he also wrote what are called progressive essays on democratic theory, and they're worth reading. They sort of say pretty clearly what everybody thinks. His conception, he says, look, we have a democratic society, fortunately. It's not an absolutist dictatorship. And in a democratic society, there's two classes of citizens. There are the people that he called the responsible men. Those are the old men of virtue, you know. That's a small group. Anybody who writes about this is always in the group, naturally. So there's the responsible men, and then there's the rest. Now, by the 1920s, you don't call them the rabble anymore, at least publicly. Maybe you do privately. So there's other words for them. But kind of the unwashed masses, there's the rest of them. We have to protect them. We have to protect them from interfering with public affairs. And the reason is they're so stupid that if they ever interfered, they would just cause trouble, you know. So it's kind of like a three-year-old running across the street. You know, you don't, can't allow a three-year-old that kind of freedom. It's too dangerous. So for their own good, for the, of say, the 80 or 85% of the population, we got to make sure that they don't get into trouble by interfering in something which is plainly none of their business, namely managing public affairs. So we have these two parts of the population, and they each have what he called their function in a democracy. The function of the responsible men is to analyze and to think and to make decisions and, you know, to know about things and so on and so forth. And the function of the rest, the rabble, is to be what he called spectators, not participants in action. Now, since it's a democracy, they're allowed to participate to a certain extent. They said periodically they're allowed to lend their weight to one or another member of the responsible men and say, okay, we want you to lead us, not you. And then they're supposed to go home and be spectators again. That's what's called an election. That's the role of the public. They're to be spectators, not participants. Since it's a democracy, they can lend their weight to one or another member of the elite and say, we want you, and then they go home. That's what's called an election. He said, if we let the ignorant and meddlesome majority, that's what he called them, the ignorant and meddlesome majority, interfere in public affairs, it's just going to cause problems because they're too stupid to do it. Now, that's the standard view. It's in the academic literature. You read, say, the academic scholarship, people like Harold Lasswell, who founded the modern discipline of political science, pretty much, to a large, at least these areas of it. Who's a liberal, you know, a good Cambridge-type liberal. His view is that we should not succumb to what he called democratic dogmatisms about men being the best judges of their own interests. These are quotes. Rather, we should understand that they are not. They usually can't judge their own interests. We have to judge them for them because we're smarter. Take, say, Reinhold Niebuhr, who was the, you know, the guru of the Kennedy intellectuals and George Kennan and that sort of, you know, Arthur Schlesinger and those people. His view was that what he called the cool observers, you know, that's the responsible men, the cool observer, rationality, he said, belongs to the cool observers, small group of people, and their job is to produce necessary illusions and emotionally potent oversimplifications in order to keep the general public kind of on course, you know, sort of. It's very hard to find any deviation from this. Now, notice that there's always one question that's never asked. It's quite important in a doctrinal system never to ask certain questions. It's, again, the thief issue. One question that's not asked, say, by Walter Lippmann, is why he's a member of the responsible men, why Eugene Debs is in jail, say. I mean, how did that happen? You know, how come Eugene Debs is in jail while I'm one of the responsible men? Is it that I'm smarter or something like that? Well, I mean, there's an obvious answer to that question. The obvious answer is they have a different constituency. Walter Lippmann and Reinhold Niebuhr and Harold Lasswell and the rest are serving the interests of people with real power. Eugene Debs was a leading labor leader, so he's in jail, you know, for raising some questions about the First World War, which is plainly not allowed in a free society. In fact, the responsible men or the men of virtue or whatever they call themselves, they're in effect managers. If they do their job, they can stay in. They don't do their job, they go out, just like the manager of a corporation. You can say, I've got all the power, but just try to do something that'll lower profits, you know, like try to improve conditions for the workers or something like that. You'll be out in 3 seconds, you know, because your job is to serve the people with real power. But in the ideological institutions, you're not allowed to raise this question. It's a mistake to raise the question, just as it would be a mistake to raise the possibility that truisms about the media might be true. you don't want to allow these issues to be thought about or discussed and so on. They should be off the agenda. That's the theory of democracy, and there's reasoning behind it. I've been quoting from the public record. If you look at the private internal record, this is a very free society, you know, by comparative standards. So we have quite a good declassified record of internal, you know, what was actually going on inside. You can find a lot of stuff. And you find what people really thought. And it's interesting to see what they really thought. It turns out to be not very different from, in fact, kind of identical to the 17th century when they were fuming about the rascal multitude and the beasts in men's shape and, you know, all of this kind of business. So take, say, Woodrow, we'll just keep to the liberals, take Woodrow Wilson, who's the leading progressive president, you know. He and his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, were quite exercised. They were very upset about the Bolshevik Revolution, naturally. In fact, that set off the Cold War. Cold War started in 1917, not 1945. And what was it that bothered them about the Soviets? Well, you know, it wasn't that Russia was going to conquer the world. I mean, whatever you think about post-1945 period, nobody thought that Russia was aggressive between 1917 and 1945. Not even the most utter madman claimed that. But they were very much afraid of them, and they followed a containment policy. In fact, we supported Mussolini's fascism. We even supported Hitler pretty openly, in fact, because of the danger of Russia. So it was really a pretty dangerous thing. Well, what was the danger? Well, Robert Lansing, Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State, explained it. He said, this is around 1918. He said, the Bolsheviks are appealing to the proletariat of all nations, to the ignorant and mentally deficient, who by their very numbers are urged to become masters, a very real danger in view of the process of social unrest throughout the world. Okay? In other words, the problem with the Bolsheviks is that they're appealing to to the ignorant and mentally deficient, to what Lippmann publicly at the time called the ignorant and meddlesome majority. And they're saying, you guys ought to be the masters of the world. In fact, they weren't, but that's the way it looked from Washington, you know. They were afraid that they were making that appeal, and that's, we got to stop that. That's just dangerous. Woodrow Wilson was afraid that soldiers coming back from the war would have funny ideas in their head that they were picking up in Europe, where there were workers' councils being established in Germany and Italy and so on. He was even afraid that workers here might start asking for representation on a board of management. He was particularly afraid about blacks coming back, black soldiers. He said they're really getting funny ideas. He was afraid, as he put it, already, he said, I've heard that Negro laundresses are asking their mistresses for more money, claiming the money's as much mine as yours. You know, boy, we got to put a stop to this. You know, therefore we have to really, you know, we have to invade Russia, which they did. They took it pretty seriously. The British, for example, used poison gas, which at that time was like nuclear weapons, and it was no joke. And then comes an embargo and everything else. Well, so it continues. The threat was throughout the whole official Cold War, post-1945, it's the same story. You look at the secret planning documents from, say, around 1945, you know, when things are, it's still an alliance, technically. So July 1945, there's a major study of the War Department and the War Department, which is now called the Defense Department, and the State Department on the post-war world. This is July 45, you know, we're still at war, we're still in alliance with the Russians. And they discuss the problems of the future world. And they say the big problem is that there is a rising tide all over the world wherein the common man is seeking broader horizons, broader and wider horizons. That's the problem of the world. Now, where do the Russians fit in? Well, they say there is as yet no proof that the Russians have flirted with the thought of associating themselves with this, but they might, you know. The Russians haven't proven yet that they're not going to, you know, that they aren't flirting with the thought of associating themselves with this rising tide all over the world wherein the common man is seeking broader and wider horizons. So therefore, we can't take any chances. We got to go right after them, you know, surround them with military bases. They recognize that the position they were taking, namely that the U.S. has to ring Russia with military bases and close them off even from their only access to warm water port at the Dardanelles, whereas the Russians aren't allowed anything, they recognize that this looks